This is the July 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update, Volume 18, Number 7. Our theme this month is on the diet and disease relationship. On Side 1, we will cover a number of diet-related topics, including intercellular communications, healthy aging, dietary factors in health, obesity, insulin, and glucose levels in diabetes, and B vitamins and the methyl-donating nutrients. Our interview in this edition will be with Dr. William Grant discussing the ecological model of diet and disease. We will conclude this month with two reports, Functional Factors in Developmental Disorders in Children, and Arthritis, Estrogen, and Brain Function. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the July 1999 Functional Medicine Update.
Once again, it seems like we have a packed agenda. My enthusiasm, I hope, won't cause this to be such a rapid-fire delivery that it'll lose the forest for the trees, because I think we're really focusing this month on the topic of how do we really understand that there is a relationship of any importance, clinical importance, between diet, lifestyle, and disease. We have a lot of suggestions and we have a lot of intuition, but is there really strong supporting data? And if there is, where are the clinical payoffs from this data? And we're going to really focus in on some clinical specificities this month in the general construct of the ecological approach towards the use of epidemiology. And our clinician/researcher of the month will be speaking to this in some detail. Dr. William Grant will give us his insight as it relates to how this fits together, and I hope to wrap the course of this month's Functional Medicine Update around that concept. As you know, we just finished the 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, a true celebration, our most successful symposium ever, attended by more than 500 professionals, and I think we had quite a celebration, quite a party in the week that we spent in Tucson, Arizona. The theme of that symposium was modulating intercellular communication and the effect in improving function. Assessing and intervening in health problems of dysfunctional intercellular communication is really a leading-edge topic, I believe, in medicine as we move into medicine in the 21st century. Heart disease, cancer, arthritis, maturity-onset diabetes, digestive disorders, these chronic adult-onset type of conditions, how do these and other chronic diseases originate in the body? Throughout the past 70 years of medical education, practitioners and through them their patients have been taught that people are to be considered well until proven sick using the traditional medical model. This concept underlies the pathophysiological model of medical education and the practice of looking for the disease. The so-called ICD-9 code was built out of that particular supposition, that you are well until proven sick. In placing the emphasis on the diagnosis of disease, the model amplifies the importance of the taxonomic definition of disease, or so-called medical taxonomy, being able to recite on demand a specific diagnosis. Even if you don't know where it came from or what it might mean, at least you can define it. If you can name the disease, it suggests you know it. By this model, mechanisms of the origin of a disease are less important than classification of the disease. Doctors are reinforced for memorization and recitation rather than understanding how symptoms originate. Practitioners who follow the prevailing philosophy often consider a patient's chronic illness and prescribe specific medications to treat these symptoms, as if monitoring and measuring and managing symptoms is in fact managing the disease. The medications typically work by blocking specific biochemical physiological processes associated with intracellular communication. Uncoupling, blocking the intercellular message with the medication may in some cases be like shooting the messenger. Uncoupling the message may relieve the symptoms while the underlying dysfunctional process continues, and in fact may continue to greater severity. The result might be that the disorder goes underground, resulting in disease progression and ultimate pathophysiology of more extraordinary proportion. Examples of this include such things as pain medications that may manage the symptoms of arthritis, but continued use of them may actually create their own dysfunction. Or the continued use of antibiotics to treat recurrent middle ear infections in children that may create another immunological sequelae later in age of the child or the young adult that produce their own dysfunctions. Or even the use of H2 blocking drugs to manage the symptoms of H. pylori infection, in which the stealth organism is still putting pressure on the body's immune system that creates other dysfunctions. One historical reason for this emphasis on diagnosis and pathophysiology is the lack of an acceptable mechanistic explanation for the origin or prevention of chronic disease. During the past decade, however, a rational mechanistic formalism for both the origin and treatment of chronic disease has been emerging. This mechanism is rooted in understanding the alterations in intercellular communication related to the onset of chronic symptoms that precede end-organ pathology. In addition to infection and trauma, we have lifestyle, diet, and environmental influences that have all been shown to be capable of modifying genetic expression and altering intracellular messengers. This is the basis of my new consumer book entitled Genetic Nutritioneering, in which I've tried to describe this fairly sophisticated concept using specific examples that hopefully the reader can understand. The research in this area has led to the development of a new explanation for the origin of disease. By focusing on functional changes in health that occur as a consequence of altered intercellular communication, this process forms an informational paradigm for the origin of chronic disease. And I'm using that term derived from a landmark paper that was authored by Dr. Candace Peart and Michael Ruff, talking about the whole nature of endorphin binding sites and the nervous system and the immune system cross-communicating through this informational paradigm concept. In 1980, Dr. James Fries from the Department of Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine offered a groundbreaking proposition in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. In this article, titled Aging, Natural Death, and the Compression of Morbidity, he suggested that by making changes in lifestyle, diet, and environment, an individual could postpone the onset of chronic illness and modify the physiological and psychological markers of aging. In doing so, he pointed out the average age at which a person would get ill could be raised, and ultimately then one could extend their health span. Well, this was not met with tremendous reception by the medical community. In fact, the response was, if this was true, what we'd be doing is keeping older age people alive longer, and they have high utilization of medical services, and it would only accelerate the bankruptcy of the disease care delivery system by using more medical services. In 1998, Dr. Fries and his colleagues published the results of a follow-up study in which they reviewed the health of Stanford alumni over the previous 18 years. And you know, we described the results of this paper in a previous issue of Functional Medicine Update. Some of those individuals have elected to follow a health promotion program, while others did not. This study confirmed that improved lifestyle, nutrition, and exercise patterns in midlife were predictors of late adult onset disability. The study demonstrated that people with better health habits not only survive longer, but their disability is postponed and compressed into fewer years at the end of their lives. This proves, according to the authors, Dr. Fries' earlier proposition that practicing the right health habits can, in fact, reduce healthcare expenditures and extend both quality as well as quantity of life. This concept, as I mentioned, has been met with some resistance within the healthcare system for its lack of a defined mechanism by which these lifestyle, nutrition, and environmental changes could, in fact, influence health in such a remarkable way. It doesn't seem like high-tech, sophisticated medicine. To some healthcare practitioners, this concept is suggested as alternative medicine, rather than science-based medicine grounded in diagnosis and treatment. Although alternative medicine itself has been the anathema to many conventional practitioners, studies like the 1998 Fries follow-up study have given scientific weight to this precept. Wayne Jonas, former director of the National Institutes of Health Office of Alternative Medicine, recently stated, quote, "It is no longer an option to ignore alternative medicine or treat it as something outside the normal processes of science and medicine. The challenge is to move forward carefully using both reason and wisdom as we attempt to separate the pearls from the mud," end quote. A mechanism that helps us to separate the pearls from the mud for the understanding of the remarkable influences of lifestyle, nutrition, and environment on health and disease is emerging through the application of the concepts of intercellular communication that had its root beginnings in the early 20th century. Dr. Archibald Garrod, a physician at the Hospital for Sick Children in London, proposed in 1902 that the future of medicine lay in a better understanding of chemical individuality. Dr. Garrod was the discoverer of alkaptonuria, one of the first genetic metabolism diseases that was recognized. His pioneering work led to the discovery that many diseases may originate in the individual in an altered chemical milieu. This altered chemical milieu results in the modification of cellular messengers and affects the way cells communicate with each other. We now generally recognize that stress, environmental toxins, nutrition, physical exercise, and chronic infections, as examples, all influence the production and cells of various cellular mediators. These change mediators then communicate different messages to the body, resulting in altered expression of health and risk of disease. Without changing the genes, we change the message that these genes transmit to the body that then modify function. An example of this change in physiological function as a consequence of altered cellular messengers can be seen in the study of male testosterone levels before and after observing sporting events. Several studies have found that testosterone levels go down in males after they watch their favorite team lose, whereas testosterone levels go up when their teams win. Obviously, in the city where the team resides that has lost the Super Bowl, one has to search for male testosterone after the defeat. Whereas in that city where the team was victorious, males are running around enraged with the hypertestosterone state of their vicarious victories. What I'm saying is that the observation of the environment we live can influence the intercellular messages that then transmit themselves through gene expression and altered function into changes in mood, mind, memory, behavior, and physiological function. Lucinio, Gold, and Wong have proposed that stress-induced alterations in susceptibility to disease occur when an individual's perception of their environment is translated into altered cellular mediators. They propose that corticotropin-releasing hormone, CRH, which mediates behavioral and physiological response to stress, has a cross-reactivity with substances in the body that mediate inflammation, suggesting a very strong correlation between perceived stress and inflammatory disorders such as arthritis and joint and muscle pain. Dietary variables also influence cellular mediators and intercellular communication. It has been shown, for example, that individuals under anxiety will mobilize fatty acid precursors for the manufacture of cell mediators called prostaglandins from their adipose tissue. If they have been consuming a diet high in animal fats, their adipose tissue will contain higher amounts of arachidonic acid, which will result in the formation of more of the pro-inflammatory prostaglandins. If, however, their diet has been rich in vegetable oils and fish, anxiety will cause them to mobilize gamma-linolenic acid or eicosapentaenoic EPA acid from their body stores. GLA and EPA are selective precursors of anti-inflammatory prostanoids. This example demonstrates how diet can influence the way our bodies respond to stress through the modulation of intercellular mediators. Animal studies indicate that even insulin sensitivity and blood sugar control are related to dietary intake of non-digestible carbohydrate, such as oligofructose. A recent study showed that insulin and its companion intercellular mediators, glucagon-like peptide 1, glucose-dependent insulotrophic polypeptide, and insulin-like growth factor 1, were all normalized when animals were fed a diet enriched in fructooligosaccharides. This study indicates that the diet and its interaction with gut bacteria can have influence on intercellular mediators that modulate blood sugar. By a traditional compartmentalized model of anatomy and physiology, it's hard to know how a diet can influence a hormone level that controls blood sugar. But by the web-like thinking of physiology that's part of functional medicine, this becomes more well understood. Individuals who become resistant to their body's insulin message develop intracellular insulin resistance. Gerald Reaven, medical doctor from Stanford University Medical School, now emeritus professor, gave this phenomena the name Syndrome X. Syndrome X is characterized, as you know, by increased levels of triglycerides, hypertension, and increased risk of cardiovascular disease, obesity, and gout. Individuals who are resistant to their own insulin message have been found to be resistant to other intercellular mediators associated with appetite control, weight management, and metabolism, such as the recently discovered adipose tissue hormone, leptin. This is an important aspect of increasing risk of chronic illness, which relates not only to the production of the right intercellular message, but also the proper reception of that message. As we all know from our communications with our friends, family, or significant others, we can talk all day long, but if the message is not received in the right way by the receiver, it's as if we had no communication at all, or maybe even sent the wrong message in terms of its interpretation. It takes both a receiver and a communicator to form the bond of proper messaging. And in cells, you have the same thing. The proper message has to be transmitted and has to be received in the right way at the receptor site. A number of molecules are associated with the control of cellular function. They include such diverse classes as neuropeptides, neurohormones, steroid hormones, inflammatory mediators such as the leukotrienes or chemokines, prostanoids, neurotransmitters. These intercellular mediators that help control cellular physiology through their ability to transmit chemical messages work in a web-like system of interaction, not as single agents with single tasks. One example of this web-like interaction occurs in the intercellular mediators involved with appetite control. For instance, it's been shown that gut produces hormones like cholecystokinin, which communicates with the brain. Fat cells produce the hormone leptin, which communicates with the brain. The pancreas secretes the hormone insulin, which works with the other two hormones, regulating appetite and calorie intake. The brain produces neuropeptide Y that works with all three of these messengers. Wow, this is starting to sound like a confused traffic pattern. But it's through understanding these webs that we'll better be able to understand the etiology and the progression of disease at its root origin, rather than just uncoupling symptoms with a specific physiological blocking agent. Well, what I've tried to give you is a concept that nutrients, lifestyle, environment are known to modify things like insulin sensitivity, insulin secretion, insulin action, and could participate then in the regulation of complex, diverse functions that are associated with insulin control. For instance, for nutrients, we know that chromium, vanadium, vitamin E, and the amino acid arginine have all been demonstrated to have an effect on insulin-mediated processes and help to stabilize intracellular communication and receptivity that's focused on blood sugar control. So there's a lot of room for modification of the patient's function without it having to change their genes. We're just modifying the way their genes are expressed. Over many decades, altered intercellular communication can result in increasing risk to virtually all the age-related diseases, including heart disease, stroke, cancer, arthritis, and maturity-onset diabetes. Food plays a very significant role in modifying both the production of and receptivity of these intercellular messages. Research has demonstrated, for example, that when it is included as a regular component of the diet, soy is associated with reduced risk of both cancer and cardiovascular disease. Soy is known to contain a variety of beneficial substances, such as the amino acids arginine and lysine in the proper ratio, isoflavones like genistein and diazine, phytic acid, lignins, and soy fibers, all which work together to help regulate intercellular messages, cholesterol metabolism, and control. This is just one of a myriad of examples of how diet plays a role in modifying function. What I've tried to introduce in this preliminary discussion this month is the thought that there is a lot more that we as functional medicine practitioners can do in helping to improve the function and health of the individual than just uncoupling a mediator by blocking it with a drug that is a blocking agent or inhibitor. And we have to really look at the fact that there are other variables besides nutrients or lifestyle, such as the psychology of the individual and how the adrenal, pituitary, and hypothalamic axis of their body relate to function. I was very impressed relative to this whole concept of how the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, or the so-called HPA axis, influences function and how it can be modified by external variables, the perceived sense about the world of that individual. And this came from a very profoundly influential article that appeared in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 281, page 1304, 1999, in which the title of the study was Effects of Writing About Stressful Experiences on Symptom Reduction in Patients with Asthma or Rheumatoid Arthritis. And in this particular paper, they looked at non-pharmacological treatments for the management of arthritis and asthma-like inflammatory reactions. They studied patients with mild to moderately severe asthma or arthritis who wrote about stressful life experiences and were found to have clinically relevant changes in their health status at 4 months compared with those in the control group that didn't have a way of articulating, communicating their sense of dysfunction or disturbance about their illness. Could illness, therefore, come in part from congested communication, which translates itself into dysfunctional intercellular mediators, which then produces an alarm reaction that we call inflammation? It's a very interesting metaphor, isn't it, that we live in a time-urgent, picosecond, time-compressed society in which the major dysfunctions we see are those of inflammatory disorders, redness, red is the color of aggression, Mars, warlike, commonly associated with male-like behavior, and it relates to poor communication, rushed or chopped or incomplete communication, the inability to listen well. And what this study in the JAMA tells us is that possibly by a person using their own feedback process to listen to themselves, communicating and then receiving the message, that this in itself can be a healing power. And in fact, the editorial that followed this particular article is entitled Healing Words, Emotional Expression and Disease Outcome. And as they went on to say in the conclusion of this editorial, as has been noted before, it is not so much the nature of the treatment on offer that determines whether the medicine is alternative, but the quality of evidence adduced in its favor and growing number of studies. It is not simply mind over matter, but it is clear that mind does matter in how the body reflects function. Well, that's a powerful sense of the milieu, as we described it, of interacting variables working on gene potential that give rise to function, and sometimes just languaging things and communicating with ourselves in the right way or communicating with our patient in the right way can be a powerful healing function. It can catalyze a healing event through a physiological control mechanism of stabilizing these intercellular messengers. One of our kind supporters and long-standing subscribers, Dr. Anthony Bazan, recently shared an article that affected him quite strongly that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine recently. I want to thank Dr. Bazan. This is volume 340, page 720 in 1999. The article is entitled Geriatrics, Prevention, and the Remodeling of Medicare. And if you had the chance to read this editorial, you'll probably come away with the same opinion that Dr. Bazan and I have come away with in reading it. And that is, in reviewing a study that was authored, a principal author by Inouye, looking at 426 elderly patients at risk for delirium who were admitted to a single medical ward and received an intervention aimed at some of the major risk factors for delirium, including cognitive impairment, sleep deprivation, immobility, hearing and visual impairment, and volume depletion, that the patients with profound dementia and those who were delirious on admission were excluded. The control patients were drawn from two usual care wards and were matched for age, sex, and baseline delirium with patients who received intervention. And intervention has to do with what we call, a functional medicine approach by our parlance towards communicating and dealing with these people as it relates to their overall health, not dealing with them as separate organ systems, isolated one from the other, but looking at an overall plan, a health strategy. In this particular study, what was found that there was a very significant improvement in these people who were dealt with as a whole, looking at them as a web rather than as a collection of organ parts. The summary of this editorial was interesting. Going on to Dr. John Rowe, the editorial author, said, reorientation of the Medicare program toward the promotion of health and the prevention of disease would encourage healthier aging and, in fact, would lead to the patients being dealt with as individuals rather than as diseases. So again, that's the model that we've been describing for many, many years. I think we're now in our 17th year, as I recall, in Functional Medicine Update, and it's been the theme that has followed us along through Metabolic Update into Preventive Medicine and most recently now into Functional Medicine Update. Actually, I'm reminded that we've completed our 17th year. We're into our 18th year, so maybe I better make sure I'm getting my ginkgo biloba as we add more years here. The other thing that we recognize is that the genes are not our destiny. And I'm now quoting from a Dr. Robert Kahn, who has written the book Successful Aging, for those of you that might have had a chance to see it. How well you age in part is up to you. It's what you do to your genes. And that's a similar theme to that which I've been describing in my new book, Genetic Nutritioneering. We recognize that at age of 81, Dr. Kahn follows his own prescription for a long and healthy life. He walks up to 5 miles a day, visits a gym to lift weights, and uses a Stairmaster machine, doesn't smoke, eats a low-fat diet, and includes plenty of grains, fruits, and vegetables. Sounds like a pretty prudent thing for an 81-year-old to practice in his health promotion program. What we're seeing is that lifestyle choices and the environmental modification to match the person's genetic need is good medicine. It's based in strong science, and it is founded around the principles of normalizing intercellular messages to promote functional resilience, knowing that we're all going to be exposed to agents that may, in fact, encourage dysfunction. I've described this in a recent article that I cited previously entitled The Use of Complementary Medicine for Healthy Aging. Any of you that might be interested in a reprint of this article, please let us know, and we'll be happy to get you one. It appeared in Alternative Therapies in their Volume 4, page 42. And in this particular article, I describe molecular mechanisms of dysfunctional aging and of functional aging. In fact, I believe that it may be an attempt to try to codify within a structural perspective aspects that we all share that contribute to how we age and how functional our biological age is as associated with our chronological age. Diet plays a big role. And of course, as we started off this month's Functional Medicine Update, we asked, well, what role does diet play? I mean, where's the beef, so to speak? Where is the real payoff? Where do we know that we really should go? Because there's a lot of contradictory and somewhat confusing information. You can virtually find a support for any dietary habit pattern you might want. You'll find some author who's written some book saying, this is the way to go, and say, oh, that's the way I eat. That's the pizza diet. Yeah, that's good for me. So what is really the rational sense, the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, going back to Dr. Wayne Jonas's concept of pearls from mud? Well, there are some very good studies that are starting to develop a certain theme. Let me give you one theme, and that's the Mediterranean diet. The Mediterranean diet we've described at some length. It's the whole grains. It's a lot of fresh vegetables and fruits. It's a lot of phytonutrient-rich, P-H-Y-T-O, nutrient-rich foods that have high antioxidant potential and help to activate gene expression of detoxification enzymes. I found the paper that appeared in the subsequent editorial following it in the journal Circulation, volume 99, page 779 in 1999, that's a lot of nines, to be very, very important in understanding aspects of the Mediterranean diet. They confirm from epidemiological evidence and statistical evaluation that there is a strong protective effect of the Mediterranean dietary pattern when a person maintains it up to 4 years. Even after coming off the diet, there's a residual protective effect suggesting that they have really altered biochemistry or physiological function in such a way as to be more resilient. Major traditional risk factors such as high blood cholesterol and blood pressure were shown to be independent and joint predictors of recurrence, indicating that the Mediterranean dietary pattern did not alter, at least qualitatively, the usual relationships between major risk factors and recurrence, suggesting that there are other risk factors, other functional determinants that may precede the major risk factors, which I believe might occur at the level we don't presently look at, which are the intracellular mediators. I think alteration in intracellular mediators precede the alteration in gross risk factors. And right now, we're still on the coarse tuning knob in medicine. We're not yet down to where we need to be, which is the fine-tuning knob, looking at intracellular mediators. And therefore, the use of the Mediterranean diet can be seen to have very powerful value in altering biochemistry in such a way as to reduce the risk to cardiovascular diseases. We recognize that the same thing holds true for Asian diets in the traditional sense, and particularly diets that are higher in soy-based products, and we spent quite a bit of time talking about soy. And I want to emphasize now where we are really going with this story. Just as with antioxidants 10 years ago, we were kind of in what I call the vitamin of the month club. You probably remember it if you've been in this field for some time. That in the winter it was vitamin C, colds, and flu. In the spring it was when people started exercise, vitamin E in the heart. And in the summer, when they got out in the sun and were worried about sunburn, it was prevention of erythema-induced damage to the skin by carotenoids. So we had cyclical upswings in supplement sales. In the winter, vitamin C, in the spring, vitamin E, and in the summer, carotenoids. Well, that's not how antioxidants work, as we've learned over the subsequent 10 years. They work as teams of interacting redox-active substances, like a shuttle mill or like a relay race, with each player handling the baton and passing it to its neighbor, thereby detoxifying oxygen radicals or other free radical species and establishing the appropriate redox-reduction oxidation potential within the cell. And therefore, if we look at the soy story, we're led to the similar outcome to that of the story related to antioxidants. People are now starting to ask, well, what is the actual pharmacological molecules that are present in soy that give rise to its functional effects? And they have isolated molecules like isoflavones, genistein, and diazine. And now we see a whole array of products coming out in the market of, we have the highest potency of genistein in our product, suggesting that the more you can get, the better you are. Well, we should have learned that lesson long ago, shouldn't we? We should have learned the lesson of balance. We've been through the mega vitamin supplement era. We should be more sophisticated and more mature. A little is good, a whole lot more is better does not play out in human physiological function. And in fact, if you're at all a proponent of homeopathy, sometimes the less that you have, the more its activity. And so what I would really urge us to consider with soy is not that more genistein or diazine is better, but in balance with what function in the body and with what other constituents that are found in soy. Soy is not just a delivery system for isoflavones. Soy is a complex food with 1,000 or more different phytochemicals, nutrients. What are some of the others? Well, what about lignans? Lignans that ultimately get metabolized into compounds like Equal that has been shown to synergistically work along with isoflavones. Lignans that are removed upon extraction of isoflavones and therefore may not have their full benefit that you would have if you ate a soy-based product. The point I'm trying to make to you that we need to start looking at synergy, not just at single nutrients, and get away from this pharmacological model of giving nutrition to improve function. We need to look at families of nutrients that provide balance. Genistein is an effective stimulator of sex hormone-binding globulin production. says recent articles, but it's more effective when it's given along with lignans and the fibrous materials found in soy and other plant foods. By the way, lignans are highest in flaxseed, to give you some idea as to where they're found in high concentration, but you also find them in soy, just at lower concentration. Urinary isoflavone, phytoestrogen, and lignin excretion is seen to be very enhanced when you give fermented and unfermented soy products, with the highest level coming with fermented soy products, in that you start to liberate the bioavailable forms of these nutrients. The gastrointestinal tract plays a role in the absorption of these soy-derived hormone-balancing agents, because we recognize that the gastrointestinal bacteria, if they're the symbiotic bacteria, can break down some of the compounds found in foods to liberate into a more bioavailable form these constituents within soy. And they also can metabolize some of these compounds into more physiologically functional metabolites, as if we're getting benefit from the bacterial metabolism on modulating our own hormones. Boy, that's a really powerful ecological concept, isn't it? We have food interacting with living gut bacteria, interacting with their metabolites to our immune and endocrine system that then influences our function. It's a complex web. And by the way, those women who consume higher levels of lignans in their diet, such as enterolactone and enterodiol, have higher levels of Equal in their urine, which is the bacterial metabolite of that lignin, which then is associated with much lower incidence statistically of postmenopausal breast cancer. When one gets the full complement of these compounds, not just a single isolated ingredient out of soy, they're getting a significant different effect on their function. By the way, I just quoted from an article that appeared way back in 1982 in The Lancet, December 11th of 1982, entitled Excretion of Lignans, Enterolactone, Enterodiol, and Equal in Omnivorous and Vegetarian Postmenopausal Women in Relationship to Breast Cancer. So we know that soy, as with other foods, is a complex mixture of different substances that work together synergistically. And the lignans found in soy or in flax work together with the isoflavones to give rise to the function. The estrogenic balancing and the testosterone balancing effects and anti-proliferative properties are improved when you give these together, says a recent paper in Nutrition and Cancer, Volume 27, page 31 in 1997. And in fact, the excretion of these substances and their metabolites in the urine is obviously interrelated in a dose-response relationship to how these are found in the diet. If you don't have them in the diet, you can't excrete them. They can't wash over your cells and have an effect on gene expression, says the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 66, page 46 in 1997. And in fact, if you look in the feces, you'll find that friendly bacteria in the gut will produce these friendly molecules and produce the right messages, smiling molecules, so to speak, versus frowning molecules. I'm using a pretty big metaphor, I recognize, but I think you get the drift of what I'm saying. So fecal lignans and isoflavone excretions are interrelated then to risks that premenopausal women might have to various health problems and hormone-driven dysfunctions. This is a recent paper that also was found in Cancer Epidemiology in 1995. I think you get the drift of what I'm saying. Flax or soy working together with the lignans, working with the isoflavones, produces a different effect than isoflavones by themselves. Well, what about the carotenoids? We know that carotenoids is another interesting family of food-derived nutrients that have a whole hundreds of different relatives, lycopene, zeaxanthin, beta-carotene, alpha-carotene, canthaxanthin. These are substances that all influence function in differing ways, even though we call them all members of the carotene family. We know that lycopene is very high in tomatoes, and we know that lutein is very high in spinach. Do they have different effects? Well, we've talked about the senile serous macular degeneration, and it's a reduced risk with individuals that consume diets higher in lutein. Seems to be protective of the macula against oxidative damage with aging. And we've also heard about tomato containing lycopene having protective effect against certain types of cell transformation. I was very interested to see that in a recent American Journal of Clinical Nutrition article, page 69, page 712 in 1999, it was found that tomato consumption, particularly tomato paste, it's high in lycopene, effectively increased the resistance of DNA to oxidative damage and reduced the formation of 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, 8-OHDG, which is a marker for potential genetic damage, mutagenesis, and carcinogenesis. So we recognize that lycopene may differ in its effects from that of lutein, and therefore eating tomato-rich foods may have a different effect, for instance, on prostate cancer risk, than eating spinach, which has a lot of lutein in it that may be more helpful for the protection against ocular damage, macular degeneration. We recognize that various fruits and vegetables contain a whole array of different phytochemicals, and depending on what family of these fruits and vegetables one consumes, they might have very different effects around their function. I was very intrigued with a recent paper in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 91, page 605 in 1999, that showed that people who eat more cruciferous vegetables, which you know contain the phytonutrient family called glucosinolates, that get converted into substances like hydroxyindole and indole-3-carbinol and cyanohydroxybutene and phenylisothiocyanate, these compounds that are derived from the myrosinase enzyme in saliva breaking down the glucosinolates after you consume them from fresh cruciferous vegetables, that's broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts, that those, when stored in the bladder, seem to help to protect against bladder cancer risk because of their ability to promote detoxification enzymes. And therefore, this paper suggests that high cruciferous vegetable consumption reduces bladder cancer risk, whereas other vegetables and fruits may not confer an appreciable benefit because they do not have this detoxifying influence. So again, lycopene, lutein, glucosinolates, different effects upon the body, but taken in a whole food matrix where you get the synergy of different nutrients working together. Well, I talked earlier about insulin resistance and dysglycemia and the relationship to cell signaling. Well, we recognize again that there are a whole series of variables that can influence cell signaling and the risk to maturity onset diabetes. If we can control the insulin message, we can greatly reduce the risk to maturity onset diabetes, as a recent paper in The Lancet, volume 353, page 617 in 1999. Intensified multifactorial intervention, including antioxidant therapy and dietary manipulation, was able to have a much better outcome in the reduction of nephropathy, retinopathy, and neuropathy in patients that were insulin resistant or on their way to type 2 diabetes. We also recognize that stress management plays a role in this. A very interesting paper that recently appeared in Journal of Hypertension, volume 16, page 1721, that showed that blood pressure is related to obesity, insulin, and hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis activation. Therefore, a person under high stress has an activation of the HPA axis, it has a pressive effect upon blood pressure, that then increases insulin resistance, it changes metabolism, and results in a higher body fat deposition. And so there's a very strong correlation between stressful lifestyles, particularly chronic stress, and a cushionoid-like appearance where you start getting moon-faced and central obesity. And so if one wants to put a person on a weight loss diet, maybe they first ought to look at environmental influences of activating the stress mechanism, the HPA axis and hypercortisolemia, cushionoid physiognomy, which is not just eating too many calories, it's processing them wrong as a consequence of metabolic disturbances and how their genes are expressing the perception of risk, not being at home, not being safe, being under stress. That, again, is the Journal of Hypertension. And lastly, how about physical fitness and the clustering of risk factors that are associated with Syndrome X or this insulin resistance syndrome? Again, that was recently studied and presented in a Medicine and Science and Sports and Exercise in a recent issue, in which they showed, this is a volume 31, page 287 in 1999, that there are very strong correlations between poor fitness levels and increased incidence of insulin resistance and the metabolic syndrome associated with Syndrome X and increased risk to heart disease. So exercise patterns and fitness play a role. So you'll notice it's, again, a web, as we described earlier, setting up the right messages, the intercellular messages, mediators in the body that are associated with function, not dysfunction. What that leads us to recognize is that dietary variables may have a very profound effect in managing insulin sensitivity. We recognize that individuals can drop their blood sugar and drop their insulin postprandial levels and decrease their hemoglobin A1C significantly when they will actually adhere, comply, practice, those are all similar words, I might add, dietary intervention. Dietary intervention is a more vegetable-based diet, higher in vegetable protein, lower in saturated animal fats, lower in nutrient-depleted foods, that this kind of a dietary intervention, according to a variety of investigators and published recently, has powerful effects on normalizing insulin and reducing the risk to insulin sensitivity. Does glycemic index predict this effect? In other words, can we just say to a person, well, go on a low glycemic index diet and this will be all worked out? And the answer is no. It's more than just a simple glycemic index determination because we haven't yet determined all the variables that are involved with food beyond that of postprandial glucose levels that influence insulin and insulin receptivity. the journal Pediatrics, Volume 103, recently in 1999, described how glycemic index is a useful tool, but in and of itself not the full predictor of how diet will influence insulin sensitivity. So you need to look at kind of a semi-empirical approach by working with your patient to design the diet that best meets their genetic need and will produce a desirable postprandial insulin level and glucose level. And one can start off with a higher protein, higher unprocessed carbohydrate, high fiber diet with low animal fat and enriched in omega-3 oils, vitamin C, vitamin E, arginine, the amino acid arginines, vanadium and chromium, and examine then the effects that that has on their insulin receptivity. So I think we're moving in a very, very interesting way, and one that I think helps us to better understand the tremendous variety of tools that we have in functional medicine. Well, as you know, there's a new drug out called Zinakel that is a drug that's being used for management of weight-related problems. Zinakel has been studied extensively. It's a Roche substance. It has the name Orlistat. It's recently been approved in late April. It's been used for the management of dysfunctional insulin sensitivity, particularly the relationship of that to metabolic weight control. So that once again demonstrates to us that there's a very strong correlation using the data from this drug trial between insulin stabilization and weight management. It's not just putting people on restrictive, abusive types of dietary limitation and calling them wrong and punishing them for their bad, slothful behavior, that there may be a metabolic underpinning of their body composition problems that interrelates to their insulin resistance, which if we can then get a control over and express their genes in different ways, will result in a very marked improvement in their function. So I think the Zinakel studies tell us something about the importance of this link, don't just necessarily lead us to prescribing Orlistat as the treatment of choice. By the way, I should mention there's a very interesting paper that recently published in Diabetes Care for those individuals who do in fact have a type 2 diabetes and are at risk to neuropathy, and as you know, peripheral neuropathy is a big risk factor in this area. This paper was an intervention trial, a blinded placebo-controlled trial, on vitamin E, looking at the influence it had in the prevention of neuropathy in patients that had type 2 diabetes. And they received either 900 milligrams of vitamin E, that's about 1,000 IUs of the synthetic DL-alpha tocopherol daily versus a placebo, and there was a very statistically significant, in fact, the P was less than 0.0019 difference between the treatment group and the placebo group, with improved median motor nerve fiber activity, tibial motor nerve distal latency, and improved nerve conduction velocity. Again, it appears as if vitamin E has an agent that helps to protect against oxidative damage to the nervous system in conditions like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes, where you have upregulation of oxidative stress factors, may be of benefit. By the way, this appeared in Diabetes Care, Volume 21, page 1915 in 1998. Changing the topic only slightly, you recall that we also recognize that defects in certain enzymatic functions can relate to diet-modified disease risk. One of these that's been highly studied, and we're very pleased that we've been discussing this now for nigh on 18 years, is the homocysteemia connection. And I'm very intrigued with this, not because you're unaware of hyperhomocysteemia and the risk to heart disease and stroke and even cancer, but rather because a lot of docs are thinking that if they do not get response from vitamin B12, vitamin B6, and folate supplementation, that they then don't know what to do and give up. That, in fact, if hyperhomocysteemic levels do not come down and they've given very high doses of B12, B6, and folate, then they're scratching their head. I want to remind you once again, I know this is for some of you a review, that years ago, in the middle 1980s, we reviewed a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine by the Wilkins, a husband and wife research team in Australia, that in fact demonstrated that people that are non-responsive to B6 and folate who have hyperhomocysteemia may have a different genetic defect in one of their enzyme functions related to folate cycle control, and that was the methyltransferase step that was not necessarily going to respond to B12, folate, and B6, but rather would respond to a methyl donor like dimethylglycine, DMG, or betaine hydrochloride, which is more like a trimethylglycine. And therefore, as is shown recently in an article in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 45, page 459 in 1999, there can be a defect in an inborn error of metabolism, so to speak, in dimethylglycine dehydrogenase that is the transference agent for methyls, and therefore the folate cycle will be interrupted, and it will not respond very well just giving B12 folate or B6, even in very high doses. But if you give, along with those B vitamins, supplemental levels in the 1,000 milligram dose of dimethylglycine DMG or TMG as betaine hydrochloride, that you in fact can get marked improvement in their function. So these methyl donation pathways require a complex array of nutrients, B12 doses 1,000 micrograms a day, B6 25 to 50 milligrams a day, folate upwards sometimes of 2,000 micrograms, 2 milligrams a day, and betaine or DMG or TMG at the levels of, say, 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day, using them in combination to get the full effect on the tetrahydrofolate cycle enzymes. And this is seen in these genetic polymorphisms also with the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase gene that's described recently in an article in The Lancet, volume 353, page 1156, 1999, that shows that this methyl transferase gene is highly polymorphic from person to person, and there are different severities of penetration, with some people responding to lower doses of folate and others much higher doses, depending upon the degree of this genetic mutation. Therefore, the point I'm trying to make to you is dose may be a very important and full complement of the methyl donating nutrients, so use the full array. Well, I think we have introduced in this side of Functional Medicine Update this month a concept, and the concept is what you might call an ecological approach towards nutrition and lifestyle intervention into the management of chronic illness and chronic disease risk. It's a very different view than differential diagnosis and ICD-9-focused histopathology-based medicine. It's based upon looking at webs of interacting variables across organ systems, intercellular communication, and normalizing mediators to give rise to higher resiliency. I'd like to take this model into side two, where we're going to have the pleasure to hear from our clinician/scientist of the month, who will take this model from a statistical perspective and open some new doors of insight for us as to where we might point ourselves for new areas of breakthrough in diet modification of disease risk. So let's turn to side two of Functional Medicine Update. As you all know who are subscribers to Functional Medicine Update, this section, which is our Clinician of the Month or Advocate of the Month section, is always one of the most highly looked forward to sections because you never know what functional medicine is going to throw to you in terms of new ideas, new concepts, expanding that neuronal capacity slightly by giving some new thoughts and perspectives. And this month, we're very pleased that once again, I think we will fulfill on that objective with our interview with Dr. William Grant. Dr. Grant comes with a very different background from that of many of our clinicians who are coming up through various medical avenues. And in his case, he came up through a PhD in physics in the 1970 early period at University of California, Berkeley, having been there during the tumultuous 60s, which for many of us was our formative years in terms of our intellectual approach to our now midlife period. He's been involved with laser remote sensing and atmospheric science, working with NASA Langley, and therefore has a variety of skills in mathematics and computer modeling and physics, and also has a very deep environmental interest, working in advocacy positions with the Sierra Club, and has transferred his background and expertise recently out of his professional flow, but into an advocational flow of diet and chronic disease. I think the approach he's using is very fascinating. To me, it signals a step as to where we're going in the new millennium in looking at data, applying ecological approaches to analyzing epidemiological information, which leads to new insights and perspectives that we may lose if we don't cut across disciplines. And I think Dr. Grant, with his background and the way he approaches problem solving, gives us that cross-discipline perspective. With that kind of brief introduction, Dr. Grant, I'd like to welcome you to Functional Medicine Update. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about what applying ecological analysis to epidemiological data really might mean to the clinician as to how they're going to see this data open up new opportunities for them.
All right, well, thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here. The ecologic approach takes disease condition or health condition of total populations, and it looks at what the total population is exposed to in terms of air pollution or diet or other environmental factors. And while I originally applied this work to the study of air pollution effect on forests, I found that the same approach was quite applicable to studying the effects of diet on chronic disease. So what I do is I take either mortality data or incidence or prevalence data by country, and then take the national dietary supply data and then look at the statistics and find the dietary component or components that have the greatest statistical correlation with the disease I'm trying to explain.
That's a very fascinating concept. Let's take a specific example that I think you have opened a door for us, and that is this whole APOE genotype. And as we have talked about in past editions of Functional Medicine Update, just to remind our listeners, there are three common APOE polymorphisms that are found in human populations. There's the APOE2, APOE3, and APOE4, and we carry a double allele, one from our mother and one from our father, so we could be an APOE22, 23, 33, 34, or 44. And if you look at the association between APOE genotype and disease, and statistically there have been suggestions that APOE4 genotypes, either single or double allele, are associated with increased incidence and risk, therefore, to both Alzheimer's disease and heart disease. Recently, in the Journal of the American Medical Association, a 1998 issue, a paper by Tang et al. Talked about the APOE4 allele and the risk of Alzheimer's disease among African Americans, whites, and Hispanics. In the response to that particular paper, you wrote a very, I think, insightful editorial which describes, beyond this genetic factor of APOE genotype, that there are other environmental modifiers. And in fact, Tang did point out in his article that maybe the combination of a genotype with environmental modifiers gives rise to the expression of a disease. It's not just the determinism of the gene itself. And so I'd like you, if you would, to describe, using this APOE genotype story, how your model can provide different insight into where we might go in reducing the risk of disease.
Right, okay. My work on Alzheimer's disease was sparked by reading this paper by Ron White et al., reporting in 1996 that Japanese Americans in Hawaii had 2.5 times the Alzheimer's disease prevalence of native Japanese. And that right away to me brought to mind that if genetics plays a part, it's not really reflected in those data. Subsequently, I found that African Americans in Indianapolis have 4 times the Alzheimer's disease rate of Nigerians, again, showing that there's an environmental factor. The primary environmental factor for most people is the diet. So I got the prevalence data from 11 countries and looked at the diet components about 4 years in advance of the study and found that it was the amount of total fat that had the highest correlation, closely followed by the total amount of calories. And when I used only the 7 Western countries, I found that dietary fat with multilinear regression with fish gave the best fit of all. But it was the fish that reduced the prevalence of Alzheimer's disease, where it was the fat that was the risk factor. What this led to was a hypothesis that the primary cause, if we can use the word cause in this context, of Alzheimer's disease is diet late in life that causes inflammation, because fat gives rise to a lot of the prostaglandin 2s, which cause inflammation, whereas fish oil is well known, gives rise to prostaglandin 1 and/or 3 that reduce the amount of inflammation. And this is consistent with the other finding that people with rheumatoid arthritis who are taking anti-inflammatory drugs all the time have a much reduced risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. Now, in terms of the APOE epsilon 4, that gene regulates in part the body's ability to handle serolipids, and certainly those with more of the epsilon 4 are going to be more affected by the dietary fat than those with the epsilon 3 and the epsilon 2. That's how the two are put together.
I think this is an extraordinarily fascinating step forward and chapter in our understanding of the origin of chronic disease. In the past, this Mendelian model that we have been raised on in our education, which says that we got these characteristics from our mother and father through the transmission for the sperm and the egg and got our address card as to our health, for which we had nothing that we could really do about it, and the kind of the diseases we get are determined by those genes, is really changed remarkably in terms of your association. Because what it says is, yes, we did get these probability factors that are locked into our genes, for instance, the APOE genotype, but that it's the modifiers that we place over the genes, such as the dietary fat connection, that may lead then to the expression of these genes as a pathology. And that's a very different story than just saying, woe is us for bad genes, there's nothing we can do about it, and therefore medicine is there just to save us from our bad genes. What it really starts saying is that there are extraordinary variabilities in the way that genes are expressed, and you can see these data in cross-cultural studies or even in intra-individual studies within a country. That's a very powerful ecological model of disease, which I want to compliment you for teasing out of the data.
Thank you.
With regard to the fat connection, we know with the APOE4 genotype that there is the upregulation of the peroxisome proliferator, which then can increase oxidative stress, and it also can have an impact through the arachidonic acid cascade on these pro-inflammatory mediators. Did you look with your data at any of the fatty acid subcompartmentalization to see if it was the stearic and palmitic acids in the saturated fat, or was it the arachidonic acid? In other words, were there certain types of animal fat that were more correlated with damage than others, or was it just general total fat?
No, in this case, I looked at animal fat, vegetal fat, and total fat. The highest association was with the animal fat, with the exception, of course, of fish oils.
When one looks at fish, is there any compartmentalization where you look at fish that are the oily salmon and herring kind of fish versus the fish that has a less body wall fat content?
Well, I'm sure there is. The colder water fish that have more omega-3 oils, but my data are not high enough resolution to be able to tease that out of it.
Let's take this model and apply it to another interesting area that you have looked at, which I think is fascinating, and that's the milk connection with coronary heart disease. And those of us that have been in this field for, well, a couple or more decades, remember the theories of Kurt Oster, who talked about milk and heart disease. And his concept was related to homogenization of milk that would then cause the micelle formation of solubilized xanthine oxidase. And he suggested that the pasteurization of milk is what contributed to increased atherogenesis, because it would result in the absorption of these enzyme molecules, xanthine oxidase, that would then create damage to the arterial wall. The model that you're deriving seems much more reasonable in terms of the association between milk and its constituents and heart disease. Could you tell us how your ecological model is applied to this area?
Yeah. I went back to the debate that was raging in the 60s between Ansel Keys and John Yudkin. Ansel Keys was a proponent of animal fat as the primary cause of heart disease and atherosclerosis. And John Yudkin, who studied diabetes, was saying, no, no, it's sugar. But they did all their work on men aged 55 to 59, and looking only at animal fat, sugar, they could only find animal fat as being the primary culprit. What people were seeing at that time was that it was clogging the arteries by lipids, and they made the assumption that it was the transmigration from the diet, from the colon into the arteries, that provided the clogging. What they failed to consider was that perhaps it was the simple carbohydrates in the diet that were being converted to triglycerides and low-density cholesterol that were actually doing the clogging. And what I quickly showed was that for younger women below the age of about 65, the highest correlation between ischemic heart disease and diet was with the sweeteners in the diet. And of that, I'm pretty sure it's the fructose that's most important, because glucose is very common in starch, and Japanese have very little heart disease, and insulin helps take care of the starch for the most part. But then, going on further, I was actually reading the works by Kilmer McCulley on homocysteine and realized I'd forgotten the whole field of animal proteins. So I went back, and one thing led to another, and eventually I found it was the lactose that had the highest correlation, which is what people have been finding since the early to mid-70s anyway, with the ecologic approach. But the medical system relegated that to the alternative literature. Because of that, nobody's done the case control on cohort studies. But if you think about it, lactose is a simple carbohydrate. If the body gets it in excess, it may want to store it as triglycerides and low-density cholesterol. Now, the fact that men and women behave differently, it turns out that for men of all ages, lactose has the highest correlation with heart disease, and that's on any group I can look at, whether it be Asia, Latin America, Western countries. Whereas for women, it's only the older women that have the lactose connection, and the younger women have the sweeteners connection. And I think that estrogen and other adaptations to being a mother protect women from lactose until they pass menopause. That's a story I've come up with on heart disease, and it seems to be supported by the recent studies showing that a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet provides no more protection against heart disease than a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet.
One of the very interesting things out of your paper is the story concerning non-fat versus whole-fat milk. I think the dominant feeling right now in most of the nutrition world is that whole-fat milk is atherogenic and non-fat milk is more cardioprotective, and it seems your data comes up with a different association.
That's correct. I think the heart association is giving the wrong advice.
Could you tell us, for those that haven't had the chance to read your paper, what you did find as it related to fat versus no-fat milk?
What I do is I separate out the various components of milk or diet. It was the lactose component that had the very, very highest association with ischemic heart disease for men and older women. The milk fat component or animal fat component had a lower association.
One of the things that I'm really interested in is your initial insight as related to the debate between Ansel Keys and John Yudkin, and those are most historically important for all of us to go back and study because it started a lot of the early thinking about diet and its relationship to chronic disease. Of course, another name that I don't think you mentioned, but you imply his work, is Dr. David Krichewski at Wistar at Philadelphia, who has done a lot of work on the protein relationship between dietary protein intake and heart disease. And it was, I think, Krichewski who first showed in animal models that it was the combination of fat and sugar together that may be the most atherogenic. And he proposed an insulinogenic mechanism where the sugar would stimulate insulin and it would drive fat into a more atherogenic situation. So it may be this complex array of different substances in the diet that are more promoted in their activity as a consequence of the higher sugar content.
Right. I've seen his 1980 paper on baboons and cholesterol with various forms of sugar, and indeed lactose and fructose were among the highest ones in combination with cholesterol in terms of forming the triglycerides.
Yes, for our listeners, that's probably a very good point because, as you know, there's this book out that's done very well called Sugar Busters, and in fact, we were pleased to have interviewed one of its principal authors a number of months ago on Functional Medicine Update talking about the sugar connection to coronary heart disease. And the Sugar Busters book has been criticized by some powers that be, saying it's too simplistic and it doesn't deal, you know, with the broad aspects of cardiovascular disease and diet. But what it does do is that by taking a very simple thing, and I'm not talking about Dr. Morrison Bethea, who's one of the authors of Sugar Busters, what it does do is it makes very simple a whole series of complex nutritional variables. Because if you cut sugar down in your diet, you're going to cut atherogenic fat down as well as a consequence of the fact that sugar and fat tend to travel together in processed food. I think what you've helped us to understand is that it's not just sucrose that's coming out of sweetened processed foods, but it also is the disaccharide lactose, which is made up of glucose and galactose. It sounds to me like it's the total simple carbohydrate load in combination with the protein and fat content that we need to be looking at.
Right, good point.
Let me shift to another application of your model, the ecological approach to analyzing epidemiological data, and that is your recent work on prostate cancer risk. And I think this is another very exciting area, knowing that prostate cancer is rising in its prevalence and concern in the male population and has a very close link to breast cancer in terms of its both frequency and its incidence of death in individuals who have it. So there's a kind of a counterpoint, women with breast cancer and men with prostate cancer. And in fact, there's a link between breast cancer in sisters and prostate cancer in brothers. So could you tell us a little bit about your prostate cancer work?
Okay. The earlier ecologic studies on prostate cancer found the link with either animal fat or total fat, but the correlation coefficient, the R-squared, was only about 0.5, and that's not really very high in this kind of study. What I did is I reading some of Kilmer McCulley's work where he thought that milk was involved in cancer, I started looking at the various cancers to find which one had a milk association, and prostate cancer popped up. It eventually turned out to be the non-fat portion of milk that had the highest correlation with prostate cancer, and R-squared were around 0.7. I then looked in the literature and found there were half a dozen cohort studies that had been reported in the past 2 years for Italy, Greece, I think Norway or Sweden, United States, maybe Japan, and they'd all reported that it was the non-fat portion of milk that had the highest correlation in the diet, not fat at all. Then Ed Giovannucci at Harvard Medical School, the key person in this field, he found the milk connection, but he links it to the calcium in milk, and his hypothesis is that calcium removes the circulating vitamin D to the point where vitamin D, which has been shown in vitro to fight prostate cancer cells, is not very effective, and that may be the mechanism. He's also shown, and as have others, that tomatoes are very protective or reduce the risk of prostate cancer. The active ingredient is lycopene. What my work has done is now shown that if I look at 20 to 30, 35 countries, I can confirm these cohort studies, and I can also find the relationship between the amount of tomatoes and the amount of non-fat milk in the diet so that one can know how to balance the calcium and the lycopene and to avoid prostate cancer. Now, you mentioned breast cancer. My work and that of others has indicated that it's really the diet early in life that plays more of a role in breast cancer than the diet late in life, and that it's most likely the dietary fat. Now, they find, for example, that the taller women are, the more likely they are to get breast cancer, and that's due to diet early in life. Earlier menarche, that means more estrogen. And so, you know, the common thread, again, is milk. And so countries with more milk are going to have more calcium and more animal fat.
One of the things that you point out in your editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and I'm now quoting from Volume 280, page 1662, you go on to say that in your work with Alzheimer's and diet, that those with Alzheimer's disease also consume fewer antioxidants than controls throughout life. I think that's an interesting observation because it seems that there are covariables that might work together. A person that has higher sugar intake may, as a consequence of those dietary agents that contain higher sugar, then have lower levels of phytonutrients such as antioxidants. So can we put these two together, or are they separate independent variables as you see them?
Okay, there is a whole field of this confounding variable. If we go back to heart disease for a minute, what's often stated is that hypertension and smoking are highly correlated with ischemic heart disease. But I disagree with that in that it appears that it's sodium that's the primary determinant of high blood pressure and lack of potassium. Yet the Japanese, with a very high sodium intake in their soy sauce and very little ischemic heart disease, but a lot of stroke mortality. You then look at the smoking relationship, and you find that there's very low correlation between the number of cigarettes per capita in a country and the amount of ischemic heart disease mortality. So again, I think it's a lifestyle. Somebody smokes, they're probably going to eat fatty foods, they're probably going to not exercise very much, probably have more salt in their diet. And so there's a whole combination of factors that go together. And one of the problems I see in a lot of the medical literature I read is that they do single factor studies. They'll come out and say dietary fiber does not protect against colon cancer, for example. But they haven't looked at a whole panoply of factors, and if you look at it more carefully, I think you'd find that it's the total percentage of calories derived from plants that are protective against colon cancer, whereas the animal fat or the animal products that are the risk factor for colon cancer. So one has to be very careful in trying to figure out the primary factor, the supporting factors, and the confounding factors.
I think that's really beautifully said, and that's a wonderful message to our listeners. One might think, therefore, if they're involved with patient management, that what they're really assisting the patient is towards a normative behavior that is more directed towards an anti-aging lifestyle rather than a single therapy. It's not the pill mentality. Let's find the right pill that will fix this like you might with a pharmaceutical. What we're looking at is a series of interrelated variables. You know, as they say, there are many paths to Mecca, so there might be many routes to get a person towards this, but ultimately, there have to be a variety of changes that are associated with this anti-aging lifestyle, it would seem, coming from your analysis.
That's correct.
I was very pleased to see that Dr. Tang, in the close of his response to the various editorials, one of which was yours, said that Dr. Grant raises the interesting possibility that dietary differences among ethnic groups might contribute to the higher frequencies of diseases like Alzheimer's disease. Although he had not conducted a formal study of diet and Alzheimer's, it's been previously found that there's a robust predictor of Alzheimer's based upon plasma lipid levels that's much stronger than the ethnic group membership. So certainly the model that you're raising with your ecological approach towards epidemiological data, to me, is a much more web-like, and I'd like to think, functional medicine approach towards approaching complex issues and helping patients, therefore, to not see themselves as just predetermined disease risks, but rather as individuals with a lot of freedom to make changes that can produce more positive outcomes.
Well stated, yes.
I guess I would ask you, lastly, where do you think this model might take you in future areas? Do you have some other thoughts as to where you're going to expand this concept?
Well, I've applied it to rheumatoid arthritis. My sister has been struggling with that affliction for a while. What I found there is that the amount of fat derived from meat has the highest correlation with the expression of rheumatoid arthritis, which could be due to the arachidonic acid, it could be due to nitrates, it could be due to iron in meat. I'll leave that to the biochemist to figure out. But I will be looking at other cancers and, you know, trying to find other diseases I can apply it to, and then try to get the medical system to actually try to do more cohort studies or case control studies based on my work. Also try to do more to educate the general public.
Well, I really want to endorse and support on behalf of all of our listeners the work you're doing. I think it opens many doors for us in the way we think about both the clinical management of patients and the experimental work that will go into developing new therapies. And I couldn't agree more about this concept of looking at multifactorial variables and trying to get away from single fixes for complex issues. Certainly this ecological model, how we live in our home from the Greek ecos, pertains not only to the environment that we live in, but also our own microenvironment, and I think your work certainly helps direct us in that way.
Right.
I really appreciate, Dr. Grant, your time with us today and wish you continued progress in your work, and we look forward to seeing the fruits of your labor.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
I so appreciate the stimulation that many of our clinicians slash scientists bring to us on Functional Medicine Update, and I thank Dr. Grant for once again opening up an approach to problem solving. I think functional medicine, to a great extent, is a way of thinking as much as it is a traditional implementation functional assessment and intervention program. It's really looking at a way of thinking, of examining the patient, of analyzing data, of using our brain to establish patterns, which even computers can't do as well as the human brain. And it's really bringing back intelligence into medicine. It's very exciting to hear about new approaches for doing that, for exercising these unique faculties that we have in our central nervous system. Unique faculties, insights, breakthroughs, paradigm shifts, you know, interesting terms, ecological approaches to medicine, and new approaches for 21st century medicine, which we hear that term being used so much now. Wow, those are all pretty revolutionary concepts. What does it really mean in the context of this month's Functional Medicine Update? Well, we have what we call aha experiences occasionally in our life. Have you had one recently? If you haven't, I recommend it highly. Find a time to have an aha experience and try to have it as frequently as possible, because it's the elixir of life. It will rev you up. It'll motivate you. It'll make a lot of things just seem less stressful as otherwise, because the living experience is having ahas. And I had one. In fact, I'm very fortunate. I have kind of aha experiences frequently. I guess it's the luck of my draw. But the one that I had was recently hearing a presentation by Dr. Wakefield from England. Dr. Andrew J. Wakefield, a medical doctor, gastroenterologist at the Royal Free and University College Medical School in London, who published a paper that I read in The Lancet a number of years ago, and actually not a number, it's 1998. The title of this paper is Ileolymphoid Nodular Hyperplasia, Nonspecific Colitis, and Pervasive Developmental Disorder in Children. Now, that's a fairly long polysyllabic title. But if you did not follow this article, and you don't understand Dr. Wakefield's work, then you are ready and ripe for an aha experience. And I hope I can do justice to introduce you to this potential aha. What is this all about? Dr. Wakefield, a very traditional gastroenterologist, not trying to become a revolutionary or set the world into a different orbit, was making good observations with his colleagues, and they had come to the conclusion from their observational clinical medicine that many of the patients that they saw who had nonspecific colitis seem to also have associated conditions of developmental disorders, central nervous system disorders, particularly autism. And you recall that we had a wonderful presentation on secretin from a clinician, Dr. Jeffrey Coppelston, who told us on Functional Medicine Update about his clinical experiences in using secretin for the treatment of autistic children. We have many other clinicians, Dr. Sidney Baker and others, that are really pioneers in functional medicine who have made similar observations. I first learned about this from a very, very fine dietitian who is at the leading edge of child behavior disorder management and autism, Ms. Kelly Dorfman, who is a dietitian working in clinical nutrition areas within the greater New England, Washington, D.C. area. She has really been a pioneer in this whole area in patient education and parent education and looking at the nutrition behavior links in children. Well, as you know, the mechanism of how secretin might influence autism in a traditional sense of medicine is pretty hard to understand. I mean, using the ology approach of differential diagnosis, compartmentalized organ-specific medicine, in which we have different chapters of textbooks that isolate one organ from the other, it's hard to understand how this would work. But I think that Dr. Wakefield's paper may open up some doors as to understanding the mechanism of how secretin works in the management of autism, and beyond that, a mechanism for the production of autism. I'm not saying it is the mechanism. I'm just saying it is a mechanism. And as we have learned from Dr. Bernard Rimland over the years, it may be that autism comes from multifactorial contributions to different genotype sensitivities. But I think Dr. Wakefield is heading us down an aha towards one potential and important mechanism. Because when he looked at these children who had the nonspecific colitis and attention-related disorders or autism, he found that, yes, the correlation was very strong. And in fact, by doing some very interesting scoping of the ileal area and of the colon in these children versus controls, and then having this done in which the investigators doing the scoping didn't know which child was in what group, the data sets when presented are absolutely stunning because they show virtually no overlap whatsoever between the patients and the controls. They also show some very profoundly different influence in methylmalonic acid excretion between the patients which have very much higher methylmalonic acid excretion than the controls. Controls are tightly clustered. The patients with autism and nonspecific colitis are higher and have a much wider range of difference one to the other. What is methylmalonic acid an indicator of? And all of you rise up and immediately recite, because you've been thinking about this functional medicine model for some time, you say, well, that's a functional indication of vitamin B12 insufficiency. So why would these kids have vitamin B12 insufficiencies? Well, lo and behold, could it be because, in fact, they are malabsorbing B12? Or could it be because they're turning over their B12 more rapidly because they have an immune reaction going on at the mucosal-associated lymphoid tissue that is producing a larger amount of nitric oxide and other chemokines that are doing what? As we know, forming nitrosylcobalamin, which then denatures vitamin B12 and renders functional vitamin B12 insufficiency. This, in the extreme case, we talked about AIDS encephalopathy as being such an example. With very severe gastrointestinal opportunistic infections, that upregulating the immune system, producing more nitric oxide, and that having a brain poisoning effect, producing encephalopathy. So the gut can be connected to the brain through the immune system and could have an indirect effect with vitamin B12 status. Looking back, if we would, at previous functional medicine clinician of the month interview we had with Dr. Lindenbaum on B12 status in older age people being associated with risk to Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases. It's not actually Alzheimer's in the classic sense, but it is a degenerative condition of apoptotic cell death in the brain caused by functional vitamin B12 folate insufficiencies that is not seen, I emphasize, not seen as a low plasma level of vitamin B12. You can have a normal plasma level and an intracellular cerebral B12 insufficiency. And therefore, the traditional physician looking at plasma might say, everything's fine, don't worry. And yet the patient is going along on the road towards increased neuronal death. Well, could the autistic child have a variant form of this in which some aspect of gastrointestinal function and upregulation of the immune system could influence brain chemistry, gut-brain connection, causing specific cellular functional changes in the brain that we associate with autism? Well, that's a very, very profound concept. It's one that's been alluded to. Certainly the secretin work suggests somehow a connection between the gut and the brain, because secretin, a brain hormone having gut effects, seems to tie those together. Well, what have we learned? What we've learned is that when these kids, and when we say learned from Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues' work, it's been learned that when you scope these individuals, look at their ileal mucosa or their colonic mucosa, what you find are very significantly enlarged lymphatic regions that penetrate through the muscle wall of the gut, and you can actually see through the epithelial tissue these almost like nodular hyperplasias, like a person that has, say, mononucleosis, when their glands under their neck become enlarged, you can see that right in the lymphoid tissue from scoping. And the severity of the lymphoid nodular morphology of the gut is directly related to the severity of autism. Very strong clinical correlation. Well, this is pretty interesting, right? Because what it suggests is that what's going on in the gut, in the immune system of that gut, where almost two-thirds of the immune system resides, influences cellular messengers that travel to the brain in these susceptible kids and influence their brain function. Well, that's a pretty bold hypothesis, and these investigators have done some extraordinary work to try to examine that as a hypothesis. And again, I don't want to leave you with the impression this is all cut and dried and sealed and delivered, but the evidence is very, very powerful, suggesting the correlation is cause and effect and not just association. Why do they say that? Well, I'm looking at, in this report on Table 2, 12 children, of which 10 have autism as the diagnosis, who all show this very strong correlation I've just described between the ileal lymphoid nodular hyperplasia and the developmental autistic disorder. Where might that have come from? Why might the immune system have been upregulated? And why does it get locked in and the child continue to have this problem? Maybe, you know, you might think an infection it would go away. Remember Dr. Martin Paul's work? We had him as a scientist of the month on Functional Medicine Update, and he talked about feed-forward cycles of immune upregulation and nitric oxide production, ATP depletion, and locking itself into a feed-forward cycle that would perpetuate itself for years, in which the symptoms might progressively get worse, even in the absence of a continuous stimulus. that it's a new state of physiological homeostasis associated with dysfunction. That's a different model of disease than we learn in school, which is agent disease. You get self-limiting disease because the agent goes away and the body recovers, but no, in this case, continued symptoms. This feed-forward cycle through the immune upregulation is a model that might be associated with it. Also, and this is where the very strong and powerful model starts to become revolutionary, in examining many of these kids, it was found that the onset of these symptoms of autism were associated, at least from a historical perspective, with the mumps, measles, and rubella vaccination. Well, this led them into a very difficult and uncharted waters, because when you start talking about a position that sounds like vaccinations may be harmful, it's like challenging motherhood to flag an apple pie. Many school systems require these vaccinations for admission of the child to school. So, wow, what are we really talking about? It turns out that Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues examined the prevalence of autism in America and in England since about 1940, looking at statistical data. Again, an ecological approach. What they found was most alarming. They found that the rates of incidence as diagnosed in England and the United States of autism was virtually the same for a period of about 30 years. And then in 1977, something happened, and that's the incidence started to rise dramatically. So that in 1998, the incidence of autism in America and England is anywhere between 6 and 8-fold higher. Did you hear what I just said? I mean, that doesn't require a biostatistician to figure that out. 8-fold higher increase in prevalence. Now, some of that could be a result of increased diagnostic specificity and sensitivity to the issue. And Dr. Wakefield has done, and his colleagues, some analysis of that. And they have, as a confounding variable, was taken into account. And it still does not account for nearly the increase in prevalence. So then he went on to say, well, was there anything that happened about 1977 that could be considered of interest? And some of you know that the vaccine was changed to a different super vaccine, a different live viral vaccine about that period. So then he went and asked with his colleagues, could there be evidence in the GI mucosa of these kids of viral injury to their mucosal cells and incorporation within their genome of viral genetic information? So they used a polymerase chain reaction amplification technique after doing a biopsy of these kids and found that, lo and behold, when they stained them in specific stains, that they showed a very strong homology of the virus genome of these vaccinations with incorporation within the GI mucosa, making these funny cells, which then had a different personality and triggered different kinds of messages. So the suggestion is, at least for some of these children, that maybe the onset of this was genetic susceptibility followed by an NMR vaccination, which resulted in a feed-forward stimulation of immunological hypervigilance that produces then a shifting to inflammatory mediators that produces ultimately then alteration in brain chemistry. Now, they also went on to demonstrate that the GI mucosal integrity of these children who are affected in this way is altered as well. And what might you expect that they found? Yes, that's correct, leaky gut. They found that the intercellular junctions of the epithelium were lost, and their intercellular junctions, rather than being tight junctions, they became loose junctions, leading to the slippage or diffusion of middle molecular weight molecules, which are proteoids in nature. And what they found in the cerebral spinal fluid, actually they didn't find it, other investigators did in subsequent reports, that the cerebral spinal fluid in these kids often are enriched in certain molecules that indicate they slipped across the gut unmetabolized, like gliomorphins and casomorphins. Now, what does that sound like? Gliadin and casein, right? Gliomorphins and casomorphins, meaning wheat and milk-derived exorphin molecules that influence endogenous opioid receptor sites, particularly if they not only go across leaky gut, but leaky brain. And remember, if you would, that the blood-brain barrier is very similar in its archetype, derived from the same embryogenic progenitor cells as is the gut epithelium. Therefore, leaky gut goes with leaky brain. Again, I'm taking some fairly sweeping generalities here without getting into all the specifics. I encourage you to read this study and the subsequent papers published by Dr. Wakefield and his group. This study in The Lancet, volume 351, page 637 in 1998, is a powerfully well-done bit of clinical observational work followed by exhaustive and extraordinary science that gives us an understanding, both from a morphological and a biochemical perspective, how there may be a connection in some autistic children between an injury to their gut and a brain dysfunction. And it may explain in part why secretin has worked, because secretin does cause an improved gut morphology, healing of the gut, which then may lower the release of toxic molecules like exorphins into the blood that then encourages brain disorders. It may also explain why secretin doesn't stay around as a positive therapy forever, because it may only be a symptom-suppressing medication by causing temporary healing of the gut mucosa rather than really dealing with the metabolic lesion that's producing this feed-forward upregulation of immune system activity in the gut that ultimately causes these brain disturbances. I really urge us to think of the Wakefield work and the ecological system model that we're developing in functional medicine, showing that cross-organ communication and the relationship that has to the environment of the individual plays a tremendous role in establishing diseases, quote, of unknown origin, end quote. If we ask different questions, we may get extraordinarily different answers. And, of course, the list of references that they cite in this paper are quite extraordinary, because it reads like a who's who for me of the last 10 years of discussing intercellular communication, biologically active peptide-containing fractions in schizophrenia and adult autism. And it ties together so much that we've learned about neuropeptides in autism and the stuff that we've heard from Dr. William Shaw. You recall we interviewed him earlier on Functional Medicine Update, talking about molecules that he's found within the plasma and urine of autistic kids, not in control kids, that are related to brain exocytotoxicity. And the fact that we see in many of these children plasma samples that indicate increased oxidative damage to the brain, increased levels of 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, 8-OHDG, that indicates mutagenic injury to mitochondrial DNA and nuclear DNA. So the point I'm trying to make, by the way, 8-OHDG doesn't reflect mitochondrial injury, but it's indirectly reflects mitochondrial oxidative injury. It does reflect a nuclear DNA damage. So what we're trying to develop is an overarching model that might allow us to understand from first principles the etiology in some children of this disorder, autism, that has not yet been amenable to traditional medical differential diagnosis and treatment. I think the functional medicine model, or whatever you want to call this, Dr. Sidney Baker calls it the good medicine model, but whatever that model is going to pay many more dividends in the treatment of this condition than just looking for the drug that will treat autism. I really want to, again, champion and support the extraordinary web-like thinking of Dr. Wakefield and his colleagues. I might add, you would expect from this cutting across many medical disciplines in public health that he's created a few ruffles in the water. And his life, he said, has become extraordinarily complicated. He used to see himself as a traditional experimental gastroenterologist in a tidy little medical academic cocoon, and everything was great as long as he got his grant money. And now, unfortunately, for him, his life has become much more complicated. But once you see the light, as he says, it is hard to go back to dimness. So he is willing to take on the role of the seeker, even in the face of academic and public health reprisals. So it's a very interesting example of what we have been talking about in functional medicine for some long period of time. By the way, as you know, the molecular mimicry that can occur in the gut with specific kinds of bacteria can also trigger the MALT and increase immunological specific reactions. I'm reminded of another article that appeared in The Lancet, volume 352, page 1137 in 1999, entitled Classification of Inflammatory Arthritis by Endocytosis. And what they go on to show is that early synovitis suggests that the first abnormality appears in swollen joints associated with spondyloarthropathy is an endothitis, inflammation at sites where ligaments, tendons, or joint capsules are attached to bone. They propose in this article that synovitis of spondyloarthropathy is secondary to liberation of pro-inflammatory mediators from the endothesis, whereas the synovitis of rheumatoid arthritis is primary. The suggestion allows of classification of arthritis as either primary, which is synovial, or endothelial, spondyloarthropathy-like, and that the pathogenesis of spondyloarthropathy may be, in fact, related to upregulation of HLA-B27 as a consequence of chemical mimicry from microorganisms in the gut that, in fact, induce this immune hypersensitivity or inflammatory reaction. So a specific genotype associated with specific pathogenic bacteria produces then an increase in the reaction of their immune system. This is the Klebsiella bacterial connection with HLA-B27 archetype. Again, another part of the model that we're developing in functional medicine. By the same token, that model also plays a role in how estrogen works in brain function in women. For years, estrogen was thought of as a reproductive hormone, and then as we started getting more advocacy in women's health issues and more women in moving into the menopause and more research going on in this area, lo and behold, estrogen was found to have a whole variety of other systemic effects, not just reproductive effects and not just anti-menopausal symptoms, not just reducing risk to osteoporosis, but even brain chemistry effects and brain activation. And I'm very intrigued by the recent paper in JAMA, volume 281, page 1197 in 1999, that showed estrogen had a very positive effect on brain activation patterns in postmenopausal women during memory tasks. They might be doing fine in their brain function until they put their brain at task, meaning a stress test, central nervous system stress test. And now, with the absence of estrogen, their neuronal reserves were reduced and they were not as functionally able to respond to task. So this again shows the functional medicine component of balance and of web-like interaction of organ system function and the importance for balancing and normalizing intercellular mediators, of which estrogen obviously is one of this family. Now you might say, does that then result in the necessity to administer hormone replacement therapy? My answer to that is it may or it may not. If the woman is estrogen deficient and has insulin resistance, then she's going to exacerbate the low effects of estrogen on her brain. And therefore, by normalizing her insulin levels and controlling insulin sensitivity, she may have more responsive effects to her estrogen and may not need hormone replacement therapy to modify and to stabilize function. And therefore, there's an interacting web of insulin sensitivity, body mass index, elevated body mass index, reduced estrogen sensitivity. So what we want to do is to look at the whole organism, look at the whole woman, not just look at her ovaries and the lack of their function. Remember that the adrenal steroidogenesis can produce estrogen as a compensating mechanism for the loss of ovarian estrogen synthesis if the adrenals still have reserve and can function appropriately. And we can do adrenal support programs. In the man, we look at insulin like growth factor 1, IGF-1, and the relative risk to prostate cancer, and say if a man has elevated IGF-1, then we probably are at risk to looking at various cancers, particularly prostate cancer, says Journal of National Cancer Institute, volume 91, page 579. And in that case, again, insulin sensitivity, hormone patterning balance, using a low-fat, higher-fiber type of vegetable-based diet with increased levels of soy-based products all makes good sense. So this month, I think we've provided you with an interesting ecological approach towards functional medicine and maybe some new research tools that help us to use the key to unlock new ways of improving patient management. Thank you.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by HealthCom International Incorporated of Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.